It's Friday, January 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, discussions about Syria continue amid serious questions. Presidential politics are about to receive direct voter input.
When you magnify that across millions of people who are getting antibiotics unnecessarily, what might have been a small risk now becomes a very real one.
Also ahead, a new way to deal with an old problem. And we look at some of country music's best. It's all on today's International Edition. Before holding talks in Saudi Arabia Sunday, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is taking part in the 2016 World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, for the next 3 days. And it follows his talks in Zurich Wednesday with his Russian counterpart, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, about political transition talks in Syria. Those talks, scheduled to get underway Monday in Geneva, appear to be in jeopardy over the lack of consensus on who should represent the opposition. But speaking Wednesday to the cable news network, UN Syria envoy Staffan de Mistura said invitations to the talks have not yet gone out, and he may not be able to say that they have until Sunday. University of Denver professor and regional analyst Jonathan Edelman tells VOA's Victor Beatty it's going to be difficult to meet Monday's deadline.
And I think the Russians are playing a clever game. I actually met Lavrov twice before he was foreign minister. He's a very smart guy. He almost functions like a computer. And so he's thinking, let's not give him another few days that maybe they might come up with something more acceptable. Because deep down, they really don't want to do most of this. So they want to just cram the UN and the pro-Western people into a bind, because there's many opposition groups, and the Russians no doubt have them all raided. And so the less time there is to resolve it, the less likely it's going to be resolved. And let's not forget that at the end of the day, they want to either keep Bashar Assad in power or one of his cronies, which is where they might actually go. The less that can be done to harm them, the better off they are. And, you know, their attacks have been fairly successful in going after some of the opposition groups.
Well, what is their game aside from supporting Mr. Assad?
Their game is that this is being looked at from their point of view, not just by Syrians, but it's being looked at all over the world, that Egyptians are looking at it, with whom they have the $2 billion, you know, military deal. And they're wondering how serious the Russians are about this effort to get back in the Middle East. Because we all know that the Egyptians, for example, kicked them out almost 40 years ago. And that was true of several other countries as well. So the way they handle themselves is not just a Russian question. It's also an effort to give the impression that we are tough, we're ready to rumble. And if you, and I'm now talking about non-Syrians, you know, want a country you can rely on, unlike in their view the United States, we're going to be there with you down the line.
The Associated Press has an interesting story about the Russian military presence in Syria, saying that they've conducted in just a few short months some 5,700 missions. And according to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, Russian strikes are directly responsible for killing more than 1,000 civilians, including more than 200 children. With this horrific cost of these airstrikes, what are they accomplishing?
From their point of view, they're showing that they're willing to do whatever is necessary to keep the Assad regime, and I'd like to emphasize, it doesn't necessarily mean Bashar Assad, but somebody associated with him, in power. And when you look around the Middle East today, for many countries, like El-Sisi in Egypt, for example, they're very nervous about what could be happening to them. So the Russians are showing them, look, we will do what we say, we will intervene, and if we have to kill a few thousand people, we're going to kill a few thousand people because they're supporting hostile elements.
The Russian foreign minister also said he spoke with Kerry about how the Russian Air Force, in planning its operations, can more closely cooperate with the U.S.-led coalition in taking into account UN, NGO, and Red Cross humanitarian efforts in Syria. It's time for us now to check our social media and what's happening out there online. To do that, International Edition's G. Abby Lee is here in the studio to tell us what's buzzing, and also about a report finding that's worsening the already chilly relations between London and Moscow. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim. So the latest report from the UK found that the Russian President Vladimir Putin quote-unquote probably sanctioned the assassination of a former KGB officer. Alexander Litvinenko is the victim's name, who later defected to the UK to work as a journalist and writer. He died in London back in 2006 of polonium poisoning.
Wow, that's quite an astonishing accusation. Give us some details about the report findings.
Sure, the report is actually 327 pages long, so I can give you as much details as you like. It included Litvinenko was murdered by former KGB agents Andrei Lugovoy and Dmitry Kovton, almost certainly on the orders of the Federal Security Service. It said Mr. Putin and the then head of the FSB probably sanctioned his death and that the president almost certainly expressed his approval after the event. The report details the lengths to which the Russian went to carry out the poisoning in London.
Wow. I'm curious as to what the RT has been tweeting about it.
Yes, as you know, RT is a state-sponsored media, and he sent out a couple of tweets on the issue, and here's one as an example. How will the hashtag Litvinenko report affect Russia-UK relations? Give us your thoughts.
Any interesting comments so far on that RT tweet?
Well, so many, but under RT account tweets that are reflecting nationalist sentiments prevailed. One of them reads like this. Do we have a list of all the people assassinated by the UK, the US, Israel, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and China? Let he who is sinless cast first stone. Another one reads like this. Britain can rapidly produce a report against Russia, but cannot produce a report on the Iraq war. Hashtag diversion. RT also interviewed Russian ambassador to the UK, Alexander Yakovenko. His Twitter handle is at @AMB_Yakovenko. And he also tweeted about the report, of course. He wrote, on Litvinenko inquiry, we will never accept anything arrived at secret and based on evidence not tested in open court. Jim?
Wow, lots of secret agent intrigue there. Thanks for that interesting wrap-up, G. And you can find her out there on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. And she also tweets from our International Edition account at @VOA_IE. You can follow me as well if you choose at VOA Stevenson. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Well, it's just about that time. Voters will finally get to weigh in on the U.S. presidential race in just under 2 weeks. That's when the Iowa caucuses select early favorites. Among the Democrats, Bernie Sanders has made an amazing surge in the polls over Hillary Clinton. VOA senior political correspondent Jim Malone joins us in the studio to elaborate on this development.
We've focused so much over the past 6 months or so on the rise of Donald Trump in the Republican race, in a way that's overshadowed what's going on in the Democratic race. And a lot of people may be now readjusting their predictions because Bernie Sanders, not only is he not going away, he seems to be on a mini surge in Iowa, where Clinton has had a lead for a long time. And for a long time now, Bernie Sanders has had a lead in the second state that'll vote, New Hampshire, which holds its primary on February 9th. So a 1-2 punch of Sanders defeating Clinton in both Iowa and New Hampshire certainly would reset the race. It might not make Sanders the favorite for the nomination. Clinton would still seem to be a strong contender. She still has great strengths with minority voters, which are a really important part of the Democratic Party. But we see of late Bernie Sanders trying to fix that a bit by reaching out to African-American and other minorities to try to bolster his support there. But yeah, you know, on one hand, the Trump phenomenon on the Republican side and the Sanders phenomenon on the Democratic side, unorthodox candidates, outsiders. It seems to be the rage for both parties this year.
What are some of the issues that Bernie Sanders is bringing up that are resonating with voters?
Well, you know, he has from the beginning focused on this sort of inequality argument that too much wealth in America is concentrated in too few people, the billionaire class, he likes to call them. I think there's some studies that shows there's several hundred, 500 billionaires in the country. So that's a pretty small group. But this argument that Sanders has been making, that there's been too much concentration of wealth, seems to be having an impact. And, you know, a lot of the candidates are trying to appeal to the broader middle class. And whether it's an economic argument that we've heard from Sanders, or in the case of Trump, it might be more of a grievance argument, that it's time to settle some old scores and people are angry and upset. Both of these things seem to be reaching voters right now. And I think all the other candidates are taking note. In the case of Hillary Clinton, she's very well known. She offers an experienced candidate. I think they're just a little taken aback at how resilient Sanders has proven. They have their work cut out for them.
Hillary Clinton was, for a while, the presumed nominee for the Democrats back in 2008, and then came Barack Obama. Does the Hillary camp see shades of 2008 starting to reemerge?
They really don't want to go down that road. And some of the supporters, I think, are getting a little worried that we're sitting in the theater and we've seen this movie before. That's why I think they're doubling down now on their efforts in Iowa to make sure the organization gets those people out on a cold winter's night. You actually have to go out in Iowa to a local community center and vote. It's not as though you're going to the polls anytime during the day you want. You actually have to go to a meeting at night. People are trying to convince neighbors who to vote for. And we'll see, you know, who's better organized in Iowa. The Clinton camp says they learned an important lesson from that loss in 2008 to Barack Obama. The question about Sanders is he mobilizing people who normally wouldn't go to vote in the caucuses? I think it's a real tight battle right now, and the Clinton people know that the best place to stop Sanders is at the beginning, because otherwise he could be on a bit of a run with what, according to one recent poll in New Hampshire, is quite a large lead.
Well, it's always fascinating to watch the run-up and, of course, then actually see how voters turn out and cast their ballots. And we're looking forward to that. Along the way, every step of the way, our VOA senior political correspondent, Jim Malone. Jim, thanks for stopping by.
Always a pleasure.
Politics or just about anything else isn't much fun if you're not feeling well. Winter months usually bring a host of seasonal illnesses, including the common cold. People deal with it in many ways, but when you get a chest cold, it's often difficult for a doctor to tell whether the infection is a bacterial or a viral infection. And that's important because one type of infection can be treated with antibiotics, the other cannot. Researchers concerned about the overuse of antibiotics have developed a blood test to help physicians make the right call. We hear more now from VOA's Jessica Berman.
Antibiotic resistance is a growing problem worldwide. Public health experts have expressed alarm that the day may come when otherwise curable bacterial infections no longer respond to antibiotics. One of the biggest culprits is treatment for routine colds. Experts say doctors often send their patient home with a prescription for an antibiotic because they cannot determine the source of the illness. Ephraim Salik of Duke University in Durham, North Carolina, is an emergency room physician. Salik says viral infections do not respond to antibiotics, and if prescribed unnecessarily, they risk the patient will become antibiotic resistant over time.
When you magnify that across the millions of people who are getting antibiotics unnecessarily, what might have been a small risk now becomes a very real one across the population.
Salik and colleagues have developed a blood test designed to make it easier for doctors to determine if the patient is suffering from a bacterial or viral illness, so antibiotics can be prescribed appropriately. The study, described in the journal Science Translational Medicine, involved 31 people, 10 with bacterial pneumonia and 21 with flu virus. From these, investigators developed the profiles of about 20,000 genes. The gene activity is different depending upon whether someone is infected with a bacterium or a virus. Then the researchers tested the blood samples of 300 sick patients. The microbes included rhinoviruses and strep infections. Salik and his team compared it to the gene profiles of people who were not sick.
And we found that we got an accuracy of 87%, which we were very excited to see, considering that there's really very little out there. And just about any ability to discriminate between these different groups is an improvement over the current state.
Currently, it takes one day for the gene expression test to yield a result. Salik says researchers are trying to whittle the processing time down to an hour or less. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
From Pink to Pitbull, Beyonce to Bruno Mars, the hits live here on the Top 20 Countdown. Hi, I'm Ray McDonald, and for the past 30 years, I've been counting down the very best of the Billboard Hot 100 Pop Singles chart. The hit list never sleeps, so don't you miss a moment of the action. Join me every Thursday for the Top 20 Countdown, right here and worldwide on the Voice of America.
Well, speaking of music, the new year, of course, is going to bring lots of new music. There was some great country music in 2015, but what's in store for this year? International Edition's Sarah Williams speaks with Nikki Strong of VOA Music about some of the most anticipated country music for 2016.
So, Nikki, I already know we can expect a new album from the iconic Loretta Lynn. It'll be her first one in 10 years. It's called Full Circle and hits stores around March 4th. What other country legends are releasing new music?
Well, Sarah, I just found out Willie Nelson, last year's recipient of the Library of Congress's Gershwin Prize for Popular Song, will salute the brothers George and Ira with a new album. It's called Summertime. Willie Nelson sings George Gershwin. It's due out February 26th. It won't be a traditional country album, but it should be good, as Willie puts his own touch on Gershwin standards like It Ain't Necessarily So, and They Can't Take That Away From Me. Vince Gill is another icon whose new CD, Down to My Last Bad Habit, drops February 12th. I love that title. Vince consistently produces great quality music, and we expect no different this year. The current single, Take Me Down, featuring Little Big Town, has a sultry country rock feel. He also has a new song with newcomer Cam on it, so I'm really looking forward to checking that out. And another artist coming back from a long break like Loretta Lynn is Wynonna Judd. The self-titled CD Wynonna and the Big Noise will hit February 12th. This will be Wynonna's first full-length studio album of original material since 2003.
Wow. What other country albums by women have fans abuzz?
Well, tons, actually. A couple of them, Brandi Clark. Now, she's a brutally honest songwriter whose single Girl Next Door is a great song that basically says, hey, you want the girl next door? Go next door. You want that girl? Go get her. Bye. So she really has guts and grit, and her CD is scheduled to drop in the spring. Lucinda Williams is another bold, gritty, passionate storyteller. Her CD, Ghost of Highway 20, drops February 5th. And another woman artist I'm looking forward to is Aubrey Sellers' debut CD. She's the daughter of Leanne Womack and prolific songwriter Jason Sellers. But she says she has her own sound that she describes as garage country, bluegrass, and blues songs presented in a new, edgier way.
Well, let's get into the guys. What do they have in store for us?
Okay, they have lots as well. I'm looking forward to Brothers Osborne, Pawn Shop. They're very funky and gritty, and they borrow from a lot of influences, including classic rock and modern country, and they do really good stuff. Charles Kelly of the group Lady Antebellum drops his solo project while the group is on hiatus, and I have loved what I have heard from him thus far. far. The single Lucky Girl was written with one of the gods in country music right now, Chris Stapleton, along with Chris Frazier. And the title track, The Driver, is really nice, too. And it's done with Dierks Bentley and Eric Pasley. And that album is due out February the 5th. Dierks Bentley, by the way, will be dropping a new album, too, called Black, which he says will be deeply personal. It's already available on pre-order, but no release date as of yet. And speaking of deeply personal, Blake Shelton will drop his album, and we all expect it to be about his relationship and public divorce from Miranda Lambert. Now, he says this album's going to be very personal, and I can already hear gossip sites right now just dissecting every single lyric. So,
well, thank you, Nikki, for this country music preview. You can find a more extensive list of the most anticipated country albums set to drop in 2016 on VOA Music's Facebook page or via Twitter at @VOA_music. You can also catch Nikki every week on Country Hits USA on VOA 1.
I'm gonna take you for a date, take you for a ride, gonna get you over there on the passenger side. I'm gonna put the radio on your favorite song, I'm gonna crank it on up and get you singing along.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at our website, voanews.com, and we invite you to follow us along on Twitter as well, the handle @VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Zeynep Abdel-Rahman. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We thank you so much for being a part of our program. Come back and spend some time with us again. Have a great day. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Entering its last year in office, the Obama administration has made it clear that engagement with Asia continues to be a top priority, with an agenda that includes economic, security, and political cooperation with Asian partners. In 2016, the United States will push for approval of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a trade agreement between 12 Pacific Rim countries. The United States will also continue to modernize its alliances and to deepen security relationships with emerging partners. In the Asia-Pacific region, the United States is ready to support its allies in building maritime security, humanitarian disaster relief, and counter-piracy capacity. Maritime security and territorial issues will be clearly on the agenda this year as well, said Deputy National Security Advisor for Strategic Communications Ben Rhodes during a recent speech at the Washington Foreign Press Center. The United States is committed to upholding freedom of navigation, he said. On issues like the South China Sea disputes, we'd like to encourage all parties to de-escalate tensions and resolve their issues through international law. The United States will also continue to cooperate with China on issues of common interest. So, for example, last year, one of the biggest issues that we focused on domestically and internationally was climate change, said Mr. Rhodes.
We would not have achieved the Paris Agreement without the cooperation that the United States and China had on that issue, both in terms of the announcement made in Beijing during his last trip and the subsequent cooperation leading into Paris.
We are going to work very closely with China on a whole range of issues related to the Asia-Pacific, said Mr. Rhodes. For example, we'll be working with China through the UN Security Council and also in our own bilateral discussions about how to demonstrate to North Korea that its recent nuclear test and the threat it poses to our allies and to the world will lead to greater costs, consequences, and isolation.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.